As he begins the second of our A.J. Allen short stories, My Adventure at Chislehurst.
Good morning, everyone. Towards the end of last September, I went to the radio exhibition at Olympia. And very fine it was, too. I drifted about, and after I'd, so to speak, done the ground floor and was going up the stairs to the gallery, I ran into a man I knew. Just at the moment, it wouldn't do at all for me to mention his name, so I'll merely call him James. But there's no harm in saying that he was a retired stockbroker and that he lived near Chislehurst. Anyhow, there he was, and he hailed me with glee and insisted on our walking round together. He was evidently starting a bad cold, which didn't attract me particularly, but there was no getting out of it without offending him, so I didn't try. We hadn't come across each other for some months, and during this time he'd gone and got married again, unexpected-like. Anyway, the upshot was that he invited me to dine with him that evening and meet his new wife. He duly picked me up at my place at 6:30 or thereabouts, and we got down to Chislehurst just before 7. We were met by the news that Mrs. James wasn't in. She'd apparently taken out her own car during the morning and gone off to see her mother, who lived at Worthing and was a bit of an invalid. Pending her return, we went into the lounge, and James began mixing cocktails. While he was doing this, I had a look round to see how much had been altered under the new management, as one would. The only unfamiliar object in the room seemed to be a large, well-lit picture hanging over the mantelpiece. James said, "That's my wife. What do you think of her?" Well, I looked and I said, "Gosh, if that's at all like her, she must be one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen." The general effect was so realistic that one almost felt one was being introduced and ought to say something. She was fair, a little bit Scandinavian in appearance, and I put her down at a shade over 30. Anyway, I just settled myself in an armchair facing the fire and the picture when the telephone bell in the hall rang. It was evidently his wife at the other end, and judging from what he said, she was stuck at Worthing for the night owing to some trouble with the car. Nothing serious, but the delay would have meant driving part of the way home in the dark, which she didn't like. But after that, the question of his coal cropped up. They talked about it for a bit and then lapsed into the sloppy type of conversation which one sort of expects between newly married people, but which is nonetheless averagely dull for anyone else to listen to. It may have been more than averagely dull in this case, because it almost sent me off to sleep. It didn't quite, but I got as far as the moment when the subconscious side of the brain begins to take control and you sometimes get entirely fantastic ideas. If you remember, I was sitting looking at this brightly illuminated picture of Mrs. James. Well, for an incredibly short space of time, I mean, you've no idea how short, the whole character of it seemed to change. Instead of an oil painting in rather vivid colours, it suddenly looked like a photograph as reproduced in a newspaper. Try looking at one through a magnifying glass. No, not now, sometime. And imagine it to be 4 feet by 3, and you'll get the same effect as I did. There was a name printed under this photograph, too, but before my mind could take in what it was, the illusion was gone, and I was wide awake again. It was all over so quickly that I just said, "That's funny," and I didn't pay much attention to it. Well, when James came in, after a lengthy and idiotic goodbye on the telephone, he was full of apologies about his wife not being able to get home and so forth. Then he went up to dress and left me alone with the picture. But although I tried from every angle, I could not manage to recapture the peculiar half-tone effect. Neither was I able to remember the name which had appeared underneath. Well, James came down in due course, and we had a most elaborate dinner, at the end of which we carted our coffee and old brandy into the lounge, and then it was getting on for 11, and I said it was time to go. That, of course, meant a final whiskey, and he was just starting on his, which he mixed with milk, by the way, when he put it down and said, "My word, I shall hear about it if I don't take my aspirin," and he went upstairs to fetch some. He was gone 3 or 4 minutes, and when he came down, he said he'd had the devil's own hunt. As he couldn't find any of his own, he'd been obliged to bag his wife's last 3. These he proceeded to take, and then I really had to go, as there was only just time to catch my train, and that was that. Well, next morning, during breakfast, there was a ring at the bell, and they came in to tell me that an Inspector Soames of Chislehurst wanted to see me. So I went out and interviewed him. He seemed quite a decent fellow, and he led off by inquiring how I was. I thanked him, and I said that I was very well indeed. He next wanted to know if I'd slept well, and I told him that I had, but even then he wasn't happy. Was I sure I'd felt no discomfort of any kind during the night? And I said none whatever, but why this sudden solicitude about my health? He then said, "Well, you see, sir, it's like this. Last night you dined with Mr. Well, James, in fact. You left him round about 11 p.m, and he presumably went straight to bed. However, at 3 o'clock this morning, groans were heard coming from his room, and when the servants went in, they found him lying half in and half out of bed, writhing with pain and partially unconscious. Doctors were immediately called in, and they did all they could, but by 6 o'clock, he was dead." Well, this was naturally a great shock to me. I asked the inspector what James had died of, and he said, "Oh, probably some acute form of food poisoning, but it wouldn't be known for certain until after the post-mortem. In the meantime, would I mind telling him everything that we'd had to eat and drink the night before?" Which I did. Actually, it was only a check, because he'd already got it all down in his notebook. I dare say he'd been talking to the cook and the maids who'd waited on us. But I didn't forget to mention the final whiskey and milk and the 3 aspirins, all of which he carefully wrote down. I next inquired after Mrs. James. Well, it had apparently been rather distressing about her. They'd telephoned to Worthing as soon as they'd found how gravely ill James was, and she arrived home just as he was dying. No one had had the nouse to be on the lookout for her at the front door, and she had got right up into the room and seen how things were before they could stop her. She then completely collapsed, which was only natural, and they had to carry her to her room and put her to bed. My inspector friend then warned me that I would have to appear at the inquest 3 days later. Well, I duly turned up, but the proceedings were adjourned for 3 weeks to await the result of the post-mortem. After that, I had another interview with the police, but they didn't ask me any more questions about food. And when the adjourned inquest came on, it was perfectly obvious why. The cause of James's death wasn't food poisoning at all. It was 50 grains of perchloride of mercury. And in case you don't know, perchloride of mercury is also called corrosive sublimate. It's used in surgical dressings, and 50 grains taken internally is a pretty hopeless proposition. In fact, according to what the very eminent pathologist person said in the witness box, it must be about as good for your tummy as molten lead. This great man then went on to give it as his opinion that the poison must have been administered not more than 8 hours before death had taken place. And as James had died at 6 in the morning, it meant that he must have taken his dose somewhere after 10 o'clock the previous night. Well, when my turn came, I told the court almost word for word what I told the inspector, right down to the 3 aspirins. Well, when they'd done with me, Mrs. James was called, and I was able to see her properly for the first time. She was even better looking than her portrait, and black suited her. One could tell that she'd had the sympathy of everyone. I mean, she would. The coroner treated her with the utmost consideration. She said that her relations with her husband had always been of the very best, and he had no worries, either financial or otherwise, and that he could have had no possible reason for taking his own life. After that, the coroner became even more considerate than ever. Witnesses were called who proved, in effect, that she had been at Worthing from lunchtime on the one day right up to 4 in the morning on the next, and there was no getting away from it. Even a mechanic from a Worthing garage was roped in his Sunday clothes. He described the trouble with her tyres and the discussion as to whether she could or could not have got home to Chislehurst before dark. There was a good deal more evidence of the same kind, and it all went to establish that whatever else had happened, Mrs. James could not possibly have murdered her husband. And as it seemed unlikely that he had committed suicide, the jury returned an open verdict. Now, what was I to do? On the face of it, and knowing what I did, it was my duty to get up and say something like this. "You will pardon me, but that woman did murder her husband, and if you like, I will tell you roughly how. She waits till he has a cold coming, and then decides to pay one of her periodical visits to her mother in Worthing. She arranges to get hung up there for the night, but she telephones at dinner time and, I suggest, makes him promise to take some aspirin and whiskey before he goes to bed. A perfectly normal remedy. She naturally takes jolly good care before starting in the morning that there are only 3 tablets of aspirin that he can get at, and these are the ones. The bottle they have been in is certainly a danger if the police get hold of it, but they don't get hold of it, because she arrives home in plenty of time to change it for another. Now, supposing for the sake of argument that I'd got up and been allowed to say all this, what would have happened? I should have had to admit straight off that I couldn't produce a scrap of evidence to support any of it. Then again, the coroner was a doctor. He would have asked me how it was possible to fake up the chloride of mercury to look like aspirin, and I should have had to agree that it wouldn't be at all easy. It happens to be a poison which the general public practically can't get, and even if they could, the tablets in which it is sold are carefully dyed blue, besides which they aren't the right shape. Well, all of this I knew. But there was another fact which I didn't get to know till afterwards, which might have made a difference. It was really rather strange. For a certain time during the war, the French army medical people had put up their perchloride of mercury in white tablets, not blue. And these did, in fact, closely resemble the present-day aspirin. Moreover, each tablet contained 17 grains. Now, 3 17s are 51, or almost exactly what James was reckoned to have taken. But all this would have gone for precisely nothing, even if I'd known it and said it, unless any of these convenient tablets could be traced to Mrs. James, and they most definitely could not. The police had searched the house as a matter of routine and analysed every bottle, whether empty or full. I might also safely conclude that they had made inquiries at all the chemists where the lady might have dealt. I know they went to mine. Then there was another thing which made it difficult to accuse Mrs. James, and that was the absence of motive. Because the obvious one, money, was practically ruled out. It transpired that she had $1,200 a year of her own. And the average woman with as much as that isn't likely to marry and then murder some wretched man for the sake of another $5,000. She wouldn't take the trouble. In fact, what with one thing and another, my theory didn't stand a hope. So I thought I'd let it stew a little longer. The lady left the court without a stain on her character, and later on went to live in the Isle of Wight. For all I know, she is still there, enjoying her 1,200 plus 5,000 a year. But whether she will go on doing it is quite another thing. Because a short time ago, I was just finishing a pipe before going to bed, when suddenly, apropos of nothing, there came into my head the name that I had seen under her picture the instant it had looked like a photograph. It was a somewhat peculiar name, and not the one under which she had married James. All the same, one doesn't just imagine a name like that. So the following day, I got my literary agent to send round to all the newspaper offices in Fleet Street and inquire whether a photograph of anyone of this name had appeared during the last few years, and they all said no. However, my agent is of a persevering nature. He has to be. He went on and tackled the illustrated weekly papers and struck oil almost at once. About 8 years ago, one of them had apparently brought out what is called a Riviera supplement, and in it was the photograph. I went along and recognized it immediately, but what interested me most of all was the paragraph that referred to it. It said that this Miss What's-her-name had been acting as companion to an old lady who had a villa at Cam. One day she, the companion, that is, had gone across into Italy to see her mother, who lived at Bordighera and was a bit of an invalid. For some reason or other, she missed the last train back and had to spend the night at Bordighera. But when she did arrive back at Cam next day, she was shocked to find that her employer had poisoned herself during the night. The paper didn't say what poison the old lady took or how much money she left her companion. But I found out since, and I'll give you two guesses.